So my talk's a little bit different than the previous ones this morning. But I'm going to talk about sort of the medical model in which we find ourselves in the laboratory world, as opposed to the more detailed, you know, within lab world that we tend to focus day to day. There's some real problems with the current model for how we do laboratory testing in healthcare today. It doesn't meet the needs of physicians very well. It does a pretty mediocre job of meeting the needs of patients. But it's reinforced by a combination of history and regulation and all of these other things that we have going on around us. What I'm going to propose today, in addition to sort of criticizing how we do things today, is propose some tools that I believe and hope can be useful in reframing some of the issues here. Some tools that represent perhaps not a revolution, because for revolution in the world of laboratory testing, we really need some external things to fall in place first. But in the meantime, for a sort of a new perspective that we in the laboratory world can take on our role in healthcare, and some tools with which we can make some real progress here. I'll get into the details in a minute. But by model, what I'm talking about, this is not a new slide on my part, but very simplistically, a doctor sees a patient, determines that for some reason a laboratory test might be helpful in diagnosing or monitoring that patient. And so the lab ends up receiving an order along with a specimen. We make sure that we don't flub up that the specimen transfer. We make sure that we get the test run accurately. We do our quality control. We kick out a result, and it goes back to the doctor, who determines what to do with it. Let me just pose the question: Where are the quality improvement opportunities in this cycle? Well, we in the laboratory world focus an awful lot on this box right here, which frankly is our box. And we make sure that we don't have a specimen mix-up error. We do spend a lot of time on QC. And I'm not saying these are bad things. But realistically, how often do we have a specimen mix-up error? You know, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000? How often do we have an analytic error? Depends on the instrument, but 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000. Certainly opportunities for improvement. How often does a doctor order the wrong test? We're talking orders of magnitude greater, 1 in 10. Might be a reasonable range. How often does a doctor get a test result and misunderstand it, or simply not understand it, or, you know, worse yet, never gets the result in the first place because of the way the office is run? But assuming they get the result, how often do they not fully understand it? Again, you know, 1 in 10 might be realistic, 1 in 100. Certainly orders of magnitude bigger than the problems that we traditionally deal with here in the laboratory. Without getting into too deep of an explanation why. This is a slide that I basically pirated from Mike Lapisada, who spoke here at the Venetian 3 years ago. And I really liked the slide, so I basically copied it. There's been this information explosion in healthcare. And we know that this is across all of healthcare, from diagnostics to therapeutics and everything in between. But the truth is that the laboratory has had a larger information explosion than anyone else. I pulled an old... Todd and Sanford off of my mentor's shelf a few months ago. And I started trying to count the number of... This was an old one. This is a 1956 one. I tried to count the number of lab tests that were referred to in there. It was a little hard to count because it listed about 10 different methodologies for just about every analyte. But it was on the order of, you know, maybe 50. How many laboratory tests can be ordered today, you know, 2007? 3,000, again, it depends how you count them, but we've grown by orders of magnitude. Physicians have not been able to keep up. It's not possible to keep up. In a world with 3,000 laboratory tests out there, what primary care physicians are going to be familiar with the ordering and interpretive, the relevant ordering indications and interpretive information for more than, say, 100 of these? It's simply not realistic. As a result, we have problems. So let's start with the variation perspective. This was an interesting study in health affairs a couple years ago. They took 17 academic medical centers, divided up costs into 5 categories. If I can remember them all, clinical laboratory was one, radiology was one, major surgical procedures, minor surgical procedures, and physician charges. Then they they segmented them by expense, basically by, you know, high utilizing hospitals to low utilizing hospitals. It was all academic medical centers. They were looking only at, I think, three different diagnostic groups to ensure a high level of standardization across these medical centers. So the variation they saw really was because of variation in practice rather than variation in patients. And they found that, first of all, the highest quintile was almost twice as expensive, spent almost twice as much money as the lowest quintile. But the laboratory costs turned out to be the highest area of variation out of all of those. Now, these were not the diagnoses here were hip fracture and colon cancer and I think MI. So these were not areas for which you even normally expect a lot of variation in test utilization. And yet, the highest utilizing centers were spending twice as much of our taxpayer money through Medicare as the lowest utilization centers. And that's aggregate. If you drill down to individual test levels, you see much greater variation depending on physician preference from center to center. If you take an error perspective on this and try to judge which test orders are appropriate versus inappropriate, the best review article I've come across so far was this one in JAMA in 98, which estimated that depending on which tests you look at and how you count them, that anywhere between 5 and 50% of lab orders are probably inappropriate. Again, that's a pretty wide range. It's pretty rough. But if we say that 1 in 10 orders really, they shouldn't have ordered it in the first place or else they ordered the wrong test, we're probably roughly in the ballpark. We've done some studies, and I won't get into the details on these, but studies at ARUP to try to get a handle on different ordering areas. Basically, what we did here was take the American Cancer Society, American Urologic Association guidelines on prostate cancer screening. Those guidelines lay out pretty clear indications for ordering a free PSA. The indications are based on what your total PSA is. The indications are also based on what the patient age is. It turns out the total PSA and age are two data elements that we have in our data repository, so it was relatively easy to take a look at what fraction of the free PSA orders we receive at our reference laboratory are consistent with the national guidelines just based on those data elements alone, and it was about half. Another interesting area to look at is inherited thrombophilia testing. This is one where the most authoritative published guidance on this is from the College of American Pathologists from a consensus conference back in 2002. For protein C, protein S, and antithrombin, the consensus conference basically said that the functional assay should be the first line test that's ordered, and the total antigen may be of research interest. It might be of occasional clinical interest, but not very often. And so we took a look. What fraction of the orders for protein C, protein S, and antithrombin were for a legitimate first-line test versus something that really should be primarily of research interest? And it was a little bit better than a coin flip as to whether doctors ordered the appropriate test. For factor V Leiden, it's a little different issue. Basically, there are two assays available, a functional and a DNA assay. Clinically, as a first-line test, they're equivalent. You might follow up on them a little bit differently, but they're both perfectly appropriate as a first-line test. The functional turns out to be about a third the cost. So which one do we get most of the orders for? The DNA. It's purely a waste of money. But when I say it's a waste of money, I have to put that in a little bit of perspective, because if you were all hospital administrators sitting out there, you would all be feeling extremely skeptical right now. I'm preaching to the choir a bit, but we need to acknowledge that from a hospital administrator perspective, the clinical lab is about 2% of the budget, and it gets treated like 2% of the budget. We get handed off to a junior administrator over quote-unquote ancillaries. The purchasing for reference services and so forth gets lumped into these group purchasing organizations, just like surgical supplies and prescription drugs. As a laboratory, we're treated as a commodity, and it has a lot to do with the fact that we're only 2% of the budget. The thing that I like to point out, we may be 2% of the budget, we drive more than half of major healthcare decisions. Some people say 70, 80%. I don't know really how you count these, but the point, just contrasting those two numbers, is that the downstream impact of laboratory orders has at least as much financial impact and probably greater financial impact than the direct cost of running the tests themselves. It follows from the fact that laboratory testing is an upstream process. It's part of diagnosis. Once you've set a diagnosis, then the downstream from that is therapy, and in some cases, follow-up testing. This is a purely made-up slide. There are no numbers behind this. It's purely for illustration. But if you think about all the different cost centers in a hospital and think of them in terms of the ratio of direct costs to downstream costs, laboratory testing is going to be right up at the top. Surgical supplies and so forth, you spend $10 on a surgical instrument, use it one time, you're done. You spend $10 on a laboratory test, comes back with a false positive, the next thing you know, you're doing a $200 lab workup. One of those tests comes back false positive, and you're spending thousands on either therapy or radiologic procedures or whatever. So we may be 2% of the budget, but we're a much bigger slice of the total healthcare process picture than 2%. And I think a lot on the administrative side of healthcare don't realize that. So it's our opportunity to educate them. There's this phenomenon called Ulysses syndrome that I just referred to. You may not have heard the name, but you're certainly all familiar with the concept. I'll tell you a personal story here. A couple years ago, I went into our own employee health clinic, which is staffed by some very good physician assistants. But again, no one's perfect. And make a long story short, I ended up having a complete metabolic profile run on me. There are no good indications for this. As a basically, healthy 30-something-year-old, it was not clinically appropriate to be ordering this shotgun panel. But I had some vague symptoms, and so the PA ordered the test. Within ARUP, by policy, I'm allowed to look up my own results. And so I looked up my own results a few days later in the computer. I was rather surprised to find that a complete viral hepatitis panel had been run. At first, I thought I'd looked up the wrong patient. I double-checked my patient ID, and then I thought that maybe there was an ordering error. Well, it turned out that my AST was just above the upper limit of normal. Now, it turns out that if you do AST, if you were to do age and sex-specific ASTs, males from about 30 to 45 tend to run a little bit higher in the overall population. But unfortunately, in our laboratory, I don't drink. But although that is a common reason for this. The point being, it's not hard. You run enough tests, some of them are going to come back false positive. Frankly, 5% of the way we set reference intervals, we're guaranteeing that roughly 5% of our tests are going to come back with false positive or false negative results. And so you run enough tests, you're going to be doing follow-ups. And the follow-ups are going to tend to lead to more follow-ups. And the psychology of testing tends to be that once you've got a false positive, then you feel obligated to rule it out in any way possible. And so it leads patients down these horrifically long pathways that really don't benefit anyone. So what can we do about it? Well, in theory, if we can get to the ordering and interpretive problem, if we can make ordering interpretation more clinically rational, then we will allow faster, more appropriate diagnoses, guarantee that, or do a better job guaranteeing that patients get appropriate therapy. In principle, should lead to shorter hospital stays and so forth. Impact on the hospital. This one's a little bit more nebulous, and nebulous because of all the different payment structures that are out there. But the bottom line is that sometime in the next decade, well, let me back up. Right now, if you're a capitated environment, you have a lot of financial incentive for efficient use of the clinical laboratory and preventing overuse. That's a relatively small part of the total healthcare picture at present. In principle, in 5 or 10 years, hopefully we'll be in an environment where quality of care is financially rewarded. In that setting, appropriate use of the laboratory is going to have much larger impacts, financial impacts on hospitals, and it's going to be just that much more to all of our, or in all of our best interests, to take an active role in this area. So back to the issue. Doctor sees the patient, orders the test, we do the test, they get the result and interpret it. For us to have an impact, we have to get out of our laboratory box and up into this box. doctors are a little bit variable in, to the extent in which they actually want us to get out of our box. But I don't believe that this is a universal kind of a thing. And that's the point of my talk here. There's a myth out there that you can't change physician behavior. It's a myth that's actively promulgated in the academic medicine community. The physician education is pointless, you can't change behavior, et cetera, et cetera. I say baloney. If you couldn't change physician behavior, why would the drug companies, which are huge multi-trillion-dollar companies, be spending half of their budgets on marketing? Now, I'm not advocating that we act like drug companies, but what I am advocating is that we pay enough attention to this to say that if they're good at getting quote-unquote educational messages out to doctors, why can't we be good at getting legitimate educational messages out to doctors? And the answer, I think, is that we actually can. But historically, laboratories haven't done as much of this as we could. I'm going to outline sort of four strategies here. You know what? I didn't start my timer. What time is it? Okay, I've got about 25 minutes, so I'm just going to subtract 20 from this. Okay, I don't want to hold you all over for lunch. Divide this up into four different strategies. I think that if we really want to have a serious impact on test ordering and interpretation, we need to pay attention to all four of them. We can't just sort of pick and choose. One I would refer to as pull. If a doctor has a question about laboratory testing, they need to get an answer as quickly and as accurately as possible. Two would be push. To the extent that we have the opportunity to push information out to doctors, and we don't have a ton of opportunities, but to the extent that we do, we need to take advantage of that. Three is what I would call analytics, that historically we do very little of in the laboratory world, but it's a huge opportunity that I'll get into in a minute, that by studying and understanding physician ordering patterns, that allows us to prioritize our efforts and target the ones who need the education most. And finally, you know, to the extent that we can, changing the rules is a powerful driver. But again, we're somewhat constrained in the rules that we can actually change in different environments. So to start with, doctor has a question about a laboratory test. It's in everyone's best interest that we get them an answer as quickly as possible. It's supposed to be a diagram of a telephone. Telephones are both good and bad. I'll start with the bad. I think that telephones are the number one biggest excuse used by clinical pathologists to not engage more actively with their clinical peers. The theory is that, you know, I'm a clinical pathologist, I have a telephone on my desk, therefore any doctor who has a question about laboratory testing can call me, therefore if they have any misconceptions, it's their fault and it's not anything that I can do about it. So it becomes this huge crutch, an excuse. The second problem with the telephone is that it's not scalable. In our laboratory, we do, about 50,000 lab results a day. And some significant fraction of those are going to have doctors that have a question about follow-up testing or interpretive issues or whatever. Now, we take, on average, about 20 phone calls a day from our physicians at our client sites that get routed through to a pathologist. A lot more phone calls that can get answered by client services, but about 20 that get routed through to a pathologist. 20 versus 50,000, there's just a huge gap there. There's no way that a pathologist on a telephone is going to answer all of the questions that physicians have on a day-to-day basis. Having said that, there is a good thing about a telephone. I think that any laboratory that's offering clinical testing has an ethical obligation to provide 24/7 pathologist ordering and interpretive guidance. And frankly, not all laboratories do that, but this is my little ethical beef at the moment. But on top of that, it's a huge learning opportunity. If you're tracking your phone calls, if you're paying attention to the topics that are coming in on the phone, it's like a steady stream of sentinel events. It's an opportunity to learn where the educational gaps are so that you can beef up your efforts in other areas. So if the telephone's not scalable, what is? Well, the internet's beautifully scalable. There was And the easiest place to start is with an online laboratory directory. There was an Archives of Pathology and Lab Medicine article, and probably one of you in this room wrote it, but I can't remember who that was, looking at online test directories at laboratories. This was a couple of years ago. They concluded that there were actually, outside of the national regional labs, there were very few laboratories that offered online test directories as of a couple of years ago. I'm hoping that all of you in this room have good online test directories, but I don't know that for a fact. Having an online test directory is great. It gives you the names of the tests and the specimen requirements and so forth, and it's a great start. But the huge opportunity here is to link that to clinically oriented, disease-oriented ordering and interpretive guidance. Because it's one thing for a doctor who wants to order a protein C total antigen to go onto your website and find out what tube they need to draw to get that. It's quite another thing to go on to look it up and discover that they shouldn't be ordering the test in the first place. And that's really where we need to get. This is what we've done at ARUP. This was a project that I was heavily involved in the last couple of years. And my CME disclaimer here is to say that other labs also have online ordering interpretive guidance. So what I'm doing here is offering this for illustration because my own lab is the one that I'm most familiar with. But we had a website up for a number of years that had, we called it our Physician's Guide to Clinical Laboratory Testing. But we did a major upgrade recently, this past fall. So calling it ARUP Consult, searchable by test name, by disease name. Importantly, it's disease-oriented. So, for example, celiac disease. We don't have an entry for tissue transglutaminase antibodies, or I should say, we don't have an entry for gliadin antibodies all by itself. But we do have an entry for celiac disease, because, again, if you're looking at gliadin antibodies, there's a good chance that you don't know that tissue transglutaminase is actually the preferable first-line test. And so we want to present those, you know, side by side. So if you go on our site, we've got the different tests that are available, a description of the indications, important limitations that you should know. So this is where it says, if you scroll down a little bit, that you don't order gliadin unless the patient's under 3 and has a negative TTG. And then where applicable, we've put some follow-up information here. For celiac disease, it's complicated enough that we also have a PDF that's available on the site that gives the recommended ordering algorithm. These are all of this, and I'm not showing this on the slide, but all of it is hyperlinked to relevant review articles, clinical guidelines, and the like, so that you can link right off of the site and pull the information that you want. So this is, you know, this is the sort of model that I propose on the poll side of things. Doctor has a question. You ought to give them a convenient website, and by the way, it's also available for PDA, and it's free. At ARUP, we're owned by the University of Utah, and part of our educational mission is to do things like this, and so we're not charging for the site or for the PDA download. A couple words about push. In some ways, push is more attractive than pull because you're forcing information into someone's lap rather than waiting for them to come out and pull it. Problems with push include information overload and the fact that the doctors are only going to tolerate so many things being pushed at them. But the one huge opportunity that we need to I think, really focus on has to do with the one piece of information that doctors are already expecting from us, which is the lab results in the first place. They're expecting the results. It's an opportunity for us to format those results and present those results in a way that can be best understood. Now, this is my venting time, especially knowing that there may be a few in the audience associated with vendors and or associated with the HL7 organization. LIS to LIS HL7 interfaces work beautifully. They're wonderful labor savers. They're wonderful clerical error savers. But they have some real problems. And one of the big problems that really frustrates me is that they're built on the paradigm that a laboratory result is a single discrete value associated with a single discrete LOINC code. And that works great for glucose and sodium, and it works terribly for HIV genotype and a celiac reflexive panel. It just does not meet the physician's needs. And I think the big, won't name names, I think most of the big vendors really don't get this. And so it becomes an exercise in creativity for us to try to find ways to work around it. One thing that pretty much all of the major reference labs, including ARUP, have put some attention into, and as well as the regional reference laboratories, as well as a number of hospital-based labs, but it's certainly not a universal thing. is what I would refer to as enhanced reporting. So an example would be an HIV genotype. You report an HIV genotype over an HL7 interface. You're going to have to split it up into, you know, the 20 different drugs that are assessed for, and then you have to figure out where to squeeze in all of your different interpretive information and limitation information, disclaimer information. And it ends up being a complete mess, and it ends up getting into someone's electronic medical record, and the physicians just can't even figure out how to wade through it. On top of the fact, the insurance company just paid $500 for this completely worthless set of information. It's a very frustrating situation. So what a number of labs, including us, have worked on is another kind of a format. Again, this is just for illustration, but this is what I'll call an enhanced report that was developed by one of our vendors that we partner with for doing HIV virtual phenotypes. And it presents the information in a way that is all on one page. It's a downloadable PDF form. The physician's office can go onto a website, type in a password, and download it, stick it in the chart. So graphical color. Something to take a look at. Next topic is analytics. And let me go back to the drug company example for a minute here to illustrate. If you're my neighbor is a drug rep. I won't tell you what drugs she pushes because that would get me off onto another topic. But my neighbor's a drug rep. And when my neighbor goes into a physician's office, she doesn't go in blind. Or to put it another way, you may have this sort of mental model of drug reps that they go around to every doctor's office in the community on a regular rotation basis and give them samples and try to give them some educational information and so forth. That's not quite how it works. Before attempting to get into a doctor's office, my neighbor has a list provided from headquarters, from her drug company seniors, that lists every physician in the community, how many prescriptions they wrote for the drug of interest in the last month, how that changed from the month before, and how many of the competitors' drug of interest were prescribed the previous month and the month before that. And so that becomes very powerful information. The doctors who order the drug that you're trying to push month after month after month, even though you only go in once a year with a Christmas present, you don't have to bother with them. You know, you show up once in a while just to keep a relationship and drop off the samples. The doctor who orders the competitor's drug and continues to order the competitor's drug month after month after month, even though you've been in there five times trying to argue them out of it, you don't waste your time with them either. You spend your time on the doctor who used to order your drug and they switched to the competitor's drug last month. And there's this game that the drug companies play, and it all revolves around the analytics that they have. Where do they get this kind of data? They buy big databases from the pharmaceutical benefit they buy the drug databases from the distributors, I believe, and then they merge them with the AMA master file provided by the American Medical Association, and then they come up with their data that they can distribute to their drug reps. Again, I'm not advocating that we take a drug company approach in our education. What I am advocating is that to the extent that they do intelligent things that actually work, that we could pay attention to this and learn from it. So the analogy here with laboratory testing, we've got literally thousands of laboratory tests that can be ordered today. A typical hospital menu might have 500 tests on it, but you know that there are another 2,000 reference lab tests that get ordered from time to time. How on earth do you monitor all of those? You can't. You don't have time. You certainly don't have time to go do chart review on all of them to determine the appropriateness. So you need to do something more sophisticated, something more scalable. What we've come up with at ARUP is a program that we call ATOP, or Analyzing Test Ordering Patterns. It's a service we offer free of charge as in an effort to improve the diagnostic care of patients, basically. It's done from a medical perspective. There are certainly cost implications to lab utilization, but that's a secondary focus in the service that we're doing. What kind of data do we have available to us? Well, at ARUP, again, we're a reference lab. We don't have the electronic medical records available to us. We don't have claims data because we're not, except in very rare cases, we're not doing third-party billing. But we do have orders, and we do know, we have all the different orders on the patients for the esoteric testing that we perform, and we know the results on all of those patients, and we know age and sex. And it turns out that just with that very limited data set, you can tell quite a bit. So for hepatitis C, the big problem here is that there are a handful of hospitals, well, more than a handful, about 10% of the hospitals we look at around the country are still ordering Rebas. Reba became obsolete, 10, 15 years ago when HCV PCR came on. Not that it's totally obsolete, but it's a test that's very rarely needed today, whereas 15 years ago it used to be a routine confirmatory test for a positive hep C screen. So the question facing us is, looking at a hospital's data, how can we tell if they're over-ordering Reba? Well, an easy thing to do is to use HCV PCR as a rough surrogate for the number of patients they're following with hep C, and then compare that to the number of Rebas that they do. So it's just a ratio of two sets of orders. If they're using Reba appropriately, they should be ordering maybe 10% the number of Rebas as PCRs or fewer. The hospitals that are having problems with this tend to be about a 1-to-1 to 1-to-2 ratio. Age distribution can be helpful. Urine VMA, very few doctors actually seem to realize this today, looking at all the hospitals that we've looked at. But VMA for adults should have become an obsolete test the day that plasma and urine metanephrines became available. Most of these are patients for whom you're ruling out a pheochromocytoma. Metanephrines is a much better test than VMA. VMA is obsolete. VMA is still useful in pediatrics looking for neuroblastomas. And so it's easy to look at an age distribution and determine that of the 50 VMAs that your hospital sent us last month, 45 of them were patients over the age of 12, and therefore your doctors need some education. And finally, result distribution. CA125 is a very useful tumor marker, but there are pockets around the country where this gets used in primary care as a screening test. It's a terrible screening test, in spite of the fact that Gene Wilder supposedly, according to the email that keeps spreading around the internet, supposedly is convinced that this would have saved his wife's life had she just gotten a CA125 from her primary care physician. So there are pockets in the country where this is used inappropriately, and you can screen for that by looking at positivity rate. If your positivity rate's under 1%, the CA125s are being badly overordered. If it's 25%, that's probably a pretty reasonable distribution to expect on an oncology population. Couple of quick case studies. So the question in your mind is, does this do any good? I'll just give a couple examples of some successes we've had with this. One was a large academic medical center. I won't name names here, but they're a very well-respected center with a very, very active clinical pathology department that does a great job with managing utilization of testing. But yet when we took a look at their orders using our methodology and being able to compare to other academic medical centers, we identified that they were ordering too many Rebas. Now, the pathologists were a little bit surprised at this because they knew full well that Reba should be an obsolete test in most of these cases. So they asked the question, why are we ordering so many Rebas? Well, it turned out the lab manager was there in the room and said, well, wait a minute, we've got an interpretive comment that goes on every single positive HCV screen that we result out that says, if you want a Reba, call the lab. So they were inadvertently promoting a test that they didn't really want to promote. And so it's easy to pick on them, but the truth is, again, you've got thousands of tests that can be ordered today. It's really hard to manage every single one without having a more sort of a data analytics approach to this. I'm sorry. My slides are out of order. That was that slide. The other case, so if you're trying to follow along reading on the slide, you've just been confused. The other example was another large academic medical center. I can tell the same story about these folks because, again, a very clinically engaged clinical pathology department that really already does a lot to manage utilization in their setting. But by looking at the big picture, we were able to identify that they were sending out about $50,000 a year worth of whole blood drug screens. It caught our eye because almost no one orders whole blood drug screens ever. We pointed it out to them. They were a little bit surprised to see that because it hadn't hit their radar screen yet. But a little investigation turned up that their transplant services, Their renal transplant service had been sending out a lot of these whole blood drug screens because they have a lot of anuric patients. And all of the other solid organ and bone marrow transplant services in the hospital had cut and pasted pieces of the kidney transplant protocol onto their transplant protocols, and bingo, they're sending out huge volumes of tests. But I pointed out to them, it was fairly straightforward for them to negotiate with their transplant services to change the protocol, bring all the testing in-house, do it on urine, save them a ton of money. So I've gone over pull, I've gone over push, I've gone over, make sure I've still got a couple minutes, and gone over analytics. The last category is the one I'm going to spend the least amount of time on, but not to say that it's not important, but you know, changing the rules is ultimately the most powerful thing that we can do to influence test ordering and interpretation. By changing the rules, I mean changing the structure of how, of the structure of the processes in which laboratory tests are ordered and interpreted. It's difficult to change rules because the healthcare system is not set up to be terribly flexible, but there are some opportunities we have. To the extent that we have requisition forms, the lab often has control over those, and we can make sure that we've optimized the requisition forms to promote first-line tests as opposed to less often indicated tests. Physician order entry is one that a lot of laboratories are looking at as a big savior, that they believe that this is going to give them the tools that they need to put barriers in front of ordering inappropriate tests. My personal belief is that at least in the short run, CPOE is going to be a challenging one for us to do as much as we want to with it. The doctors just don't put up with a lot of screens flashing at them saying, are you sure you really want this? But to the extent that we can, at a bare minimum, every hospital implementing physician order entry needs to have a clinical pathologist on that committee deciding how those rules are set up and how the orders are set up. So we need to have a seat at the table. Couple words about panels, because that's another structural issue that's under our control. I'm running out of time here, but I think in the laboratory world, we've had a very customer service-oriented perspective for a long time. We felt like if a doctor asked for a panel, that we need to give it to them, because we can't risk offending our physicians. The problem with that is that we end up setting up a lot of panels that some doctor asks for that may not be actually medically appropriate. You know, even despite all of the Medicare rules that we're following, there's still a lot of panels out there that don't make a lot of sense. And I think we need to take a more active voice in giving them the panels that the patients need, not the panels that the doctors are asking for. And the final issue is with diagnostic utilization committees. If you're a doctor at Las Vegas General Hospital, you can't order just any prescription drug that you feel like on your patients. You can only order the drugs that the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee say you can order, because they're the ones that determine the formulary. And they're the ones that determine policies under which drugs need a second layer of review, et cetera, et cetera. Why is it that you can order any laboratory test in the world just by free texting it into the order blank? And odds are the laboratory is going to get that test ordered for you. And I think it's a disconnect. I think it's a cultural issue, and I think that every healthcare provider needs to have a diagnostic utilization committee to address these kinds of things. Politically, it's an opportunity for the pathologists and the clinician leadership to get into the same room and negotiate a lot of these issues. There are a few examples out there. I throw out Group Health Cooperative and Vanderbilt as examples that have done this successfully. There are probably more out there, but they're definitely the exception rather than the rule. So in summary, there's a lot of overuse, misuse, and underuse of laboratory tests in this country. Laboratories traditionally have not put a ton of attention into that, although it's certainly something we've all been aware of, but there are tools available that we can use to make a real difference in this area. And my other pitch is that you see your reference laboratories as a potential partner in this, because there's some areas such as analytics where your reference laboratory can provide you benchmarking that may not be easy for you to do in-house. So it's something that, in addition to partnering with your vendors and your reference labs in other areas, this is an area that should be on the table for discussion. Thank you for your patience, and I don't know if we have time for questions. I can certainly take some offline.